Empty your pockets, shoes, and laptops in the tray. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The attack in Istanbul has put airport security front and center again. The question is, can airports really be safer?
Public areas of airports are inherently vulnerable because they're so open. That's the whole point of them. They're meant to be public areas that anyone can move into.
Plus, it's been a week of Shakespearean drama in British politics.
Politics has never been, and never will be, nice people sitting around a comfortable table in warm, cozy chairs agreeing on everything.
Sounds a lot like British families now, too.
Young people saying to their parents and grandparents, oh, you've sold out our future, you know, you've ruined the country for us just in time for us to grow up.
Those stories today here on The World. Glad you could make it here at the start of this holiday weekend. And let's face it, for many of you, the long weekend started actually last night, the big midsummer holiday. Later in the show, we'll be talking summer camp and sausages, but right now, travel is on our minds. Ever since the bombings at Istanbul's international airport earlier this week, we've been thinking about security and how far to go to be secure. And I mean that in the literal sense, because in Istanbul, you start to go through security even before you get to the airport terminal. Ben Vogel is editor of IHS Jane's Airport Review. What happened at Istanbul Atatürk Airport, Ben? What went wrong there in terms of security?
The initial indications are that the three attackers were able to bypass the vehicle checks, which take place about 500 meters away from the terminal, because they were traveling in a taxi. And the people who were conducting the vehicle checks may have recognized the fact that the taxi firm was being used, and they just waved the vehicle through.
So that was the weak link right there. They figured the taxis wouldn't get checked.
It appears to be, with the caveat that, of course, the investigation is still ongoing.
Taking on board, as you say, once again, the fact that the investigation into the Istanbul attack is still underway, what lessons have we learned in the aftermath of the airport attack there?
Well, I suppose the main lesson is that public areas of airports are inherently vulnerable because they're so open. That's the whole point of them. They're meant to be public areas that anyone can move into. I would say that the attack does bear a similarity to the attack in Brussels at Zaventem Airport in March 2016, in terms of it being on a public area, a landside area. In a way, it shows perhaps the strength of checkpoint security. It's getting harder and harder to smuggle explosives through the main security checkpoint. So instead, the focus of the attacks is in the public area.
Well, we have a huge holiday coming up this weekend in the U.S., holiday weekend, July 4th. A record 43 million travelers are expected. What measures are being taken at airports in the U.S.?
As far as I can tell, the TSA is stepping up its presence at large airports such as Chicago O'Hare and main international airports throughout the country. Local police departments have increased patrols, and sniffer dogs are being deployed to look at pickup zones outside the entrance to airports.
I don't want to be alarmist, but it sounds like what you were saying about Istanbul Atatürk Airport is, if attackers really want to, they will find a way to attack.
Well, in a way, you're right. A lot depends on the ability to foil plots before they actually reach fruition. And that speaks a lot to the ability of intelligence services around the world to keep track of emerging threats.
Ben, you've been to many airports around the world. You've seen them up close. What airport's doing the best in terms of security? And if you can just tell us why.
The thing is that airports differ in terms of their traffic volume and the kind of traffic that they deal with, whether it's leisure, business, point-to-point passenger traffic or transfer traffic. They all have different operational tempos, and even the physical size of an airport differs, as you'd expect. And all those variables have an effect on how security is provided. In the case of Atatürk, the recent spate of bombings and terrorist attacks in Turkey meant that the measures in place at that airport were actually tighter than many other airports around the world, including, arguably, many in the United States.
What about the visuals, the optics of just having a lot of security personnel at an airport? Is there any correlation between the number of security and deterrence?
I think a visible presence is necessary not just to potentially deter anybody and then monitor potential hostile reconnaissance that takes place, but also to reassure the traveling public, particularly in the aftermath of one of these horrible terrorist attacks. But I don't think it necessarily has a direct relationship with the efficiency and effectiveness of the security.
It was also pretty remarkable how quickly Istanbul picked back up and started flights again and kept the airport open. What do you think accounts for that?
I think it was partly a sense of getting back to business as usual and making sure that this a vital piece of strategic infrastructure, it is a major airport in the region, got back up and running as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it's got to instill some confidence in the public, though, when they see that.
It shows that there is a resiliency about Ataturk, that it was able to recover so quickly.
Ben Vogel, the editor of Jane's Airport Review. Thanks for your time, Ben.
Thank you.
Even before the bombing on Istanbul's main airport this week, Turkey's tourism industry was hurting. Now the fear is it's only going to get worse. Kemal Mert is a tour guide in Istanbul. I started by asking him to tell me more about his business.
We start from Istanbul and then we go to Cappadocia.
Which is supposed to be absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful, believe me. You should come and see.
Well, I'd love to someday. Where else do you go?
Then after the Cappadocia, I'll take my travelers to the southern part of Turkey, the Mediterranean coastline. So we take a boat, overnight boat actually, and we sleep on the boat under the stars.
Mm. So a real deep dive into kind of Turkish history and sites.
Exactly.
There's been kind of a relentless strike of a terror attack since last fall in Turkey. How has business been affected, your business specifically, like compared today with a day a year ago?
With one word, it's terribly affected. So right now, if you ask me what you're doing for a living, I'm an interpreter right now. I'm interpreting, translating. As I have two languages, I'm luckier than the others, basically, because I also can speak Japanese. So, you know, there are so many Japanese companies around the world, and same in Turkey. So the other guides are working for some other companies, but not for tourism, of course. Real estate business, some of them. Most of them, they apply for jobs for airlines to be a flight attendants.
So since you're doing interpreter work, I assume you've had lots of clients who've canceled trips. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's true. Actually, I'm still working. We haven't canceled our contracts with our companies. For example, I work for G Adventures. It's a very good company, actually.
Canadian company.
Canadian company, yeah, that's right. So I was, me and my other colleagues, we were supposed to start the season at the beginning of May. But as you know, the bombings happened and they said us we should wait until July. And then the attack happened 2 days ago. After that, they canceled the whole year. And most of them, my other colleagues, they went back to their hometown.
With your work as an interpreter, are you able to make the same amount that you would be if you were running tours?
No. Not even close.
How are you able to survive then?
Well, first of all, I'm single.
That helps.
Yeah, that helps a lot. If I was married, I was in trouble. I was in real trouble. But right now, I can survive with this. And hopefully, we all hope to see our travelers again starting from next year, because as you know, Turkey has a really deep history and lots of beautiful places.
Would you ever consider leaving Turkey?
No way. For example, I have relatives living in France. So, you know, terrorism happened in France as well. So should they leave France? No, that's what they want, actually. Terrorists want us to leave our places and, I know, be horrified and scared. No, instead of doing that, we should always stay strong. That's how we survive.
Kemal Mert is a tour guide in Istanbul who's seen big losses to his business this year. Kemal, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Malcolm.
Let's talk Iraq for a moment, and no, this does not come from the really bad news file. Relatively speaking for Iraq, this is a slice of life story. And life these days in Iraq, southern Iraq especially, is, in a word, hot. 111 Fahrenheit in the port city of Basra today, and the people there are suffering. On Monday, when the temps hit 120, the whole city lost power. air conditioning especially, gone. Ben Lando is editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report, where we read about this. Blackouts are not unusual in Iraq, Ben. What made this one different?
Well, Iraqis in general, and Basrawis specifically, are so frustrated that something had to give, basically. Especially when you add in fasting during Ramadan and scorching temperatures, as you mentioned. The governor of Basra province, angry that Basra doesn't get enough money from Baghdad, kind of out of respect for the fact that Basra is where most of the oil is produced and exported from, and add into it some lingering, maybe sectarian, nationalistic tension between Iraq and Turkey, decided he would forcibly take over the Turkish power barges if they didn't begin operating again. They were stopped because Iraq owed it money. And he led a team to one of the port areas where one of the barges were located, and essentially, in one way or another, pressured them, forced them into restarting.
So power barges, what is this, like an electricity generating ship?
Exactly. It's like a power generator you have that in Iraq especially plugs the gaps left by the national power grid, but on a massive scale and floating on water instead of in your neighborhood.
How long has this been a thing in Basra, floating power plants?
Sure. Off and on for, I think, nearly a decade. I think 2007, maybe 2008 is when the first power barge, and it's all through the same company, same Turkish company, kind of a stopgap measure to quickly create more electricity in a time when Iraq at least had plans at that time to increase power generation. You know, nearly a decade later, they still haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah, so the boat pulls up to the docks in Basra and they start the engine. They're just not turning the rotor. They're just making electricity.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. So this is not the first time, though, that Basra's electricity has been cut off. Iran pulled the plug on Basra in April, right?
That's right. And not just to Basra, but Misan province, which is just north of Basra, and Diyala province, which is just north of Baghdad, all on the border with Iran. There's power lines that go into from Iran to Iraq. And essentially, Iraq owed something like $700 million in payments for the electricity. Iran cut it off, and then they worked out a deal, I believe, last month.
The weird thing is Basra is the center of Iraq's oil industry, and it can't generate enough of its own power? Why?
Yeah, it's a bit complicated, and a lot of it's historical. So the oil in Iraq is owned by the federal government, so Basra province doesn't have direct access to the money generated by the oil. Nearly all of the power sector in Iraq is owned by the federal Ministry of Electricity. So Basra itself, beyond needing electricity, it needs money for other basic development and reconstruction efforts. Nearly all of the province's revenue comes directly from the federal government, so it definitely doesn't have enough money to build a power plant and purchase the fuel for it. And although the oil prices are starting to increase slightly, the federal deficit is still large. Expenses for fighting the so-called Islamic State, taking care of citizens displaced by the war. It's always been a fight for a slice of the pie, but now the pie has shrunk and the hunger pangs remain the same.
Was it a lack of money that also led to the blackout? I mean, did basically Basra not pay its power bill?
It's more that the federal government didn't pay its power bill. The finance ministry didn't give enough money, I think, to the electricity ministry to pay the power bill. But Basra is the one impacted by it. The folks in Baghdad didn't feel the heat, so to speak.
Gotcha.
And that's what the Basra governor decided to take things into his own hands.
But with oil prices very low, as you point out, what does this mean in terms of Basra paying the next power bill and the one after that?
It's up to the finance ministry and the electricity ministry. They have to decide how to spend their budget, their limited budget. What Basra gets to decide, I guess what the governor gets to decide, is what steps to take now that the warning shot was heard, especially as, well, next month will be hotter than this month.
Yeah. Ben Lando, editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. UK politics on a boring day is question time in Parliament, and even if you don't know what's going on, at least it's entertaining. The past week, though, it's not been boring at all. It's been insane. So chaotic that I'm not even seeing the entertainment factor. Yes, a week after Brexit, it is a mess, and it doesn't look like anyone is rushing to clean things up. That's the word from Laurie Penny in London. She's a writer for the New Statesman.
At the moment, there seems to be just widespread panic and confusion. Conversations are about this and nothing else. They're about Brexit and nothing else. But the conversation has shifted over the past week to what's happening at the top of government, which is both Labour and the Conservatives in complete meltdown. The Prime Minister has resigned, and there's, you know, calls for Jeremy Corbyn to resign, and nobody knows who's going to be leading either the government or the opposition tomorrow, let alone next week.
I mean, the Tories and Labour, I mean, these are political parties that have been the masts of British politics for decades. What's going on?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the first-past-the-post voting system that we have here, it's similar, although not the same to what you have in the US, but it's basically designed to ensure that one of the two main political parties remains in power. But support for both of those parties has been falling over the last, certainly over the last 10, 15 years. A lot of people feel that mainstream politics in general doesn't represent them. And at the moment, those two parties seem to be in complete freefall. They are fighting amongst themselves, huge infighting, and there is a lot. I mean, if there was anger at the government last week, that's nothing compared to what's happening this week, when they've proven themselves absolutely unable to act like adults.
All this infighting in politics due to Brexit, does that trickle down to the dinner table?
Well, yes, there is a lot of infighting going on, not just between different groups of society, but within families. You know, I know people who just don't want to talk to their parents at the moment, don't want to talk to their friends. I'm lucky in that most of the people I know and am close to, not all of them, but most of them voted to remain, as I did. But there have been huge, huge divisions, huge fights. You know, young people saying to their parents and grandparents, oh, you've sold out our future, you know, you've ruined the country for us just in time for us to grow up. And, you know, people who live in the city being angry with people who live in the countryside. Scotland looking at everyone else and asking what on earth we're doing. And it goes on and on and on. So it's not just politics, and it's not just mainstream politics where there's infighting. There's infighting across the whole country, unfortunately, just at a time where what we need is unity and a progressive, tolerant vision of unity at that. It's really worrying.
I suggested earlier that no one is cleaning the mess up, but actually, if I look closely, it seems to be all men who instigated Brexit, and now it's
yes,
women
absolutely.
Who are cleaning up the mess. Am I reading that correctly?
Well, as above, so below in that respect. I think it is women, both within Parliament and in the broader country, who are going to be shouldering a lot of the burden for cleaning up the mess of this. It's certainly been spoilt men in positions of power who have led the Brexit campaign in service of their own careers. Theresa May, who's the Home Secretary now, is looking like a good candidate for leadership of the Tory party purely because there's nobody else left.
But, let me ask you about Theresa May. Don't know much about her. Home Secretary is kind of a high-level position with legislative and security responsibilities. Theresa May becomes head of the Conservatives, what does that do? Does it start to right the ship of state?
Well, one of the things that Theresa May is known for is a very harsh stance against immigration. She's been responsible for a huge crackdown against immigrants and a tightening of the rules against you know, various kinds of immigration in the UK, and it's not going to be good news for ethnic minorities and non-British nationals. So she may be a unifying candidate within the Conservative Party. Whether she's going to be a unifying candidate within the rest of the country is a very different question.
Yeah, I mean, and considering a lot of people say that Brexit was actually a referendum on immigration, what does all that portend for the future if Theresa May becomes the Prime Minister?
She's a very right-leaning candidate on those issues in particular, and a lot of people whose lives are affected by immigration will be worried. Everything in Britain, honestly, is turned on its head right now. Nobody really knows what's going to happen in politics next week. All we really know is that people on the ground are frightened. They don't know what their futures are going to look like. There's a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of blame going on, different sections of society blaming each other. And we know that it's not going to get better very quickly.
Laurie Penny, a writer with The New Statesman in London, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Since the Brexit vote last week, I've seen quite a few articles here comparing the British political scene to House of Cards, you know, the nasty political thriller from Netflix. But let's not forget the Netflix series is based on the British TV series from the early 1990s, also called House of Cards. It also had a creepy lead played by Ian Richardson. And that TV show is based on a book by Michael Dobbs. Our colleagues at the BBC got Dobbs on the line to ask what he thinks of this madcap week in British politics.
I think I've just seen the end of political fiction. My industry is ruined. How can we possibly match what we have seen going on? It is quite extraordinary.
Andy says the multiple political betrayals are pure Shakespeare.
I remember what inspired me to start writing political fiction, although I didn't realize it at the time. I was reading Julius Caesar as a schoolboy to do exams, and I thought, there's the most powerful man on the earth being stabbed to death on the steps of his own capital by his best chums. And I thought, what a wonderful story. And here we see Brutus and Cassius and Caesar and Mark Antony going at it again.
Et tu, Boris and Michael and David and Nigel, but do they all have to be throwing their toys out of the baby carriage? That's what the BBC put to Dobbs.
In order to get things done, you have to break things, and sometimes you have to break colleagues. It is a competitive game. Politics has never been and never will be nice people sitting around a comfortable table in warm, cozy chairs agreeing on everything. There has to be. All the greatest politicians have been controversial, have been gone through crises. So there is nothing really new about what we're seeing, except it is a bit unusual to see it happening all, before tea time on the same day.
And Michael Dobbs should know. He worked for conservative leaders Margaret Thatcher and John Major back in the day. The Guardian newspaper once called Dobbs Westminster's baby-faced hitman. But right now, it's not just politics and politicians that are divided. So is the country.
Even as a novelist and a dramatist, as well as a politician, I see a big divide that somebody at some point has to bridge between the establishment, the bubble around London and one or two other places, and what's going on in the rest of the country. It's a very creative area for dramatists, but it's a real challenge to practical politicians, and one I think that this referendum has highlighted.
So Brexit should be great fodder for fiction. Just don't forget how the story usually ends, Dobbs says.
The system requires sacrifices, and sometimes it requires sacrifices of principles. That is the practical reality of politics, and we will never get away from that. The success comes, of course, in making sure that you don't go too far and you actually happen to keep a balance between practical politics and those principles. And not everybody manages to do that.
Did you hear that, pro-Brexit people? That was House of Cards author, the author of the original House of Cards, Michael Dobbs, speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, we're going to tell you how the sausage is made. Kielbasa, hot dogs, bratwurst, even veggie sausage.
You can still sort of nutritionally and morally feel comfortable with what you're doing, but also get the benefits of eating a sausage. Plus, you get to put it in a bun.
How cultures across the globe make meat portable. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 1 million dead and wounded soldiers. Well, that sobering figure was enough to steer attention in Britain away from their Brexit crisis. The UK observed 2 minutes of silence this morning to mark the exact moment 100 years ago that soldiers climbed out of their trenches at the start of one of the bloodiest battles in history, the Battle of the Somme in France in World War I.
Hell let loose, brother. Hell let loose.
That's an archival recording of one survivor. We'll hear more in just a minute. It was hell, and it traumatized Britain. A little background to the battle. Britain and its allies were at war with Germany, and the Somme was the first major assault by Britain in the war. It was a disaster. On the first day, a century ago today, nearly 60,000 men were killed or wounded. This was the commemoration today.
Guards in order! Royal salute! Prison! Ah!
That's The Last Post, the British version of Taps. And the soldiers? All gone now. But in the 1960s, the Imperial War Museum recorded the voices of as many survivors of the Somme as they could find.
There was nothing but brown earth,
shell holes and death. Nothing else.
There was guns, rifles, everything was going off at the same time, and people shouting and hollering, and some poor beggars you could hear that were wounded were crying for help, and oh.
That whole wood was lined with machine guns from one end to the other. The company went over 230 strong, and only 11 survived. It was ridiculous.
It was tough, too, for the men who had to bury the dead in giant pits behind the front lines.
And the poor beggars rolled down to the bottom of this. We sprung to attention, turned about and went and got some more. And we did that till we cleared the ground of all these poor fellas. And that's where they're buried, in the bottom there. How can I see them now? Oh dear. Fancy soldier crying. God rest their souls.
The World's One Man History Desk. Chris Wolf is here. Chris, I really only have one question. What went wrong at the Battle of the Somme?
Well, pretty much anything that could go wrong did go wrong, Marco. Starting with, you know, the strategic conception of the whole affair. It's almost as if the generals didn't really know what they were doing. Some historians give them some credit and say the whole nature of warfare had changed and all their assumptions were just wrong. But on the other hand, they had 2 years of experience to build on and previous wars to build on, and they still made some pretty dreadful mistakes.
Was this basically hand-to-hand combat and then a whole bunch of new technology introduced? Is that what caught people off guard?
It's more like you're talking massive industrial-scale warfare. You know, you've got the entire nation providing shells. Artillery is the queen of the battlefield, and the artillery preparation was one of the things that went wrong. The Brits had hoped to destroy all the German bunkers and they would just walk through, and sadly that wasn't the case. The artillery didn't even cut the barbed wire in front of the German trenches. The artillery lifted too soon, so the Germans were able to rush out of their underground bunkers and man their machine gun nests before the British even had a chance to get across no man's land, or in some cases even get out of the trenches. And the scale is just horrific. It's too many to believe. I mean, if you think about it, the number of men involved on the British side was about the same as the entire Allied force that landed on D-Day, about 140,000, 150,000 men. And it really makes D-Day, I can't say look like a picnic, that's disparaging D-Day, but the Allies lost about 10,000 men on D-Day. We're talking here 60,000. That's a casualty rate of 40 to 45%. And
that's
some units, it was 90%.
Chris, it's interesting. I mean, we've spoken so many times about history and about war and about battles, and yet I hear in your voice something that's very emotive about this particular one. When you've commemorated the Battle of the Somme in Great Britain in the past, what goes through your mind on this day?
It's everything from sadness at the loss and respect for the men who just went over the top regardless, and then anger at the futility of it all. I mean, after 4.5 months of battle, in some sectors the British had advanced 5 miles. In other places they hadn't advanced at all. You know, and this colossal useless waste of human life. And, you know, revisionist historians are saying the generals did the best that they could, but I don't think that that's true. I mean, like when I was in the army, you learnt fire and maneuver tactics, which is basically you don't move anywhere unless you've got covering fire. It's kind of, you know,
basic stuff.
And they knew that at the time. That's how the regular army had trained. That's how a lot of the soldiers had trained. But they decided that all the new volunteers were just not disciplined or not organized enough to do that. So they just said, get up and walk. And you think that callous disregard, it's like opting for a human wave tactic when you know that's going to cause a horrendous loss of life. That's just a callous decision that was made, and they could have done a lot better than that.
The World's One Man History Desk, Chris Wolf, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
When I think about the end of school, my thoughts turn to the start of summer camp. I had 3 great years at a sleepaway camp in the North Carolina mountains. All we did pretty much was backpack in the Blue Ridge for 6 weeks. Let me introduce you, though, to a camp that does some of that. Also, the arts and crafts thing, a bit of canoeing and campfire songs, but all in Russian. Lesnoye Ozera is a Russian language camp in Bemidji, Minnesota. Nadia Spock, one of our summer interns here, actually spent 7 summers at this camp. How'd you end up at a Russian language camp for all those years, Nadia?
Well, I actually traveled to Russia a lot as a kid. My mom did a lot of work over there, and I was lucky enough that she started bringing me along, and I started to pick up some Russian along the way. But she really thought that I should be learning when I wasn't abroad, so she suggested the idea of sending me to this Russian camp.
And you liked the idea?
Yeah, I was excited about it. I was only 8 years old, but it was really interesting because I was unlike a lot of the other campers there in that I was one of the only campers that wasn't adopted from Russia. Mm. Most of the other kids had decided to go to camp to learn about where they came from, or in some cases, relearn Russian to one day maybe meet their birth families. Mm. I spoke with one of my old friends, Svetlana Popovic, who was adopted from Russia when she was 10, about how she ended up at camp.
I wanted to relearn Russian because all the time I was pushed to learn English and Spanish and Hebrew, so I was forgetting my Russian. So my parents decided it would be a good idea for me to go there and not to lose my language and just to know my heritage.
So if a lot of kids ended up at the Lesnoye Ozera summer camp to reconnect with their Russian heritage in some way, I mean, what kind of activities do you do to do that?
Oh, there were so many things. Every day we had language classes, actually multiple times a day. We were encouraged to speak in Russian all the time if we could. Obviously, it didn't always happen. But aside from learning language, we prepared a lot of Russian food. We ate pretty much all traditional meals. We learned how to sing Russian songs around the campfire.
What's a Russian word for marshmallow?
You know, I do not know the Russian word for marshmallow,
it's been
unfortunately.
A while. What was the last year you were there, or what year?
Let's see. I don't remember the exact year, but it was the summer after my freshman year of high school.
How did a Russian language summer camp end up in Bemidji, Minnesota in the first place?
So Lesnoye Ozera is one of 15 summer camps, a part of the Concordia Language Villages in Bemidji. And they were started in the 60s. Through Concordia College, which is actually located in Moorhead, Minnesota. And the whole idea was to work on creating responsible global citizens.
Very interesting. So you were saying, Nadia, that most of the campers had roots in Russia. What about the counselors? Where were they from?
Pretty much all of my counselors were native Russian speakers. A couple of them actually lived permanently in Russia and would travel to Minnesota to work at camp in the summers. Here's Svetlana, who I actually went to camp with, and she went on to be a counselor there a few years later.
Some of them had grandmas, grandpas growing up in Russia, so they could really tell like great stories, and it's something that I never had a chance to hear from my grandma or my grandpa or my mom and my dad. It was definitely a life-changing moment for me.
So, Nadia, now that your camper days are behind you, what's your lasting memory of this camp?
So I would say that my most memorable moment at camp was my worst at the time, but probably the best now. I was so upset when my parents dropped me off at camp. Like I said, I was only 8, and I was crying every single night, and I actually moved in to the bed of one of my fellow campers, and I stayed with her the entire week.
Aww.
But the remaining years, I eventually moved over to my own bed, but we remained best friends and went to camp together every year after that.
Yeah, that's great. Those early days at camp can be a bit overwhelming, but I'm glad you stayed and very glad you're spending this summer with us at The World. Thank you, Nadia.
Thank you.
As you know, we've got a long holiday weekend ahead of us. I'll be with you here on Monday, but between now and then and on through the summer, I'm going to be standing in front of a fire with a grill on top of it. And one of my favorite things to grill is sausage. Hot dogs, knockwurst, bratwurst, you name it. If I had time, I'd make them myself. Many people on Earth can and do because, hey, sausage may be the most universal meat product on Earth. As it turns out, writer Linda Rodriguez McRobbie in London has written about sausages for the website Atlas Obscura.
The word sausage actually comes in part from the Latin salsus, which means to be salted, and that refers to how the meat would be preserved. That was later sort of turned into the old northern French sausage, which you can hear now in saucisson when you speak about French sausages. So there's a very clear line that goes through history with the word sausage.
Right. So it's a Latin word, but I mean you find sausage in almost every culture around the world. What,
absolutely.
Why is that?
Everyone has a sausage, and it's largely due to the fact that sausages are a wonderful solution to a problem that every culture would have faced. Sausages are a really good way to preserve food, to use all of the meat of the animal, to make bits of the animal that weren't probably super edible, and to make things really tasty. And so you've got, you know, cultures that are going to be dealing with preserving food, with transporting food. When hunter-gatherer culture really kind of rose up and was able to, coordinated hunting meant that people were bringing down larger game animals, then you had a lot more meat that was going to be going bad. So this is all about figuring out ways to keep meat for longer and to keep it fresher and to be able to continue to eat it and to transport it and all those things. And everyone dealt with this. Now, given that, there are a lot of differences in how sausages taste. The sort of flavor profile of various cultures is definitely different. You know, I think sausages tend to be sweeter in Far Asian cultures. Here in Britain, we've got a lot more fresh sausages. Germany has a lot more fresh sausages, the ones that need to be cooked rather than ones that are already to just, you know, ready to go and eat. So really, you're looking at kind of the same solution that is molded and modified by each of the cultures that it rose up in.
And the shape of sausage, I mean, it has that shape because it's stuffed into an intestinal casing. Is there any culture that doesn't use the intestines to shape their sausage?
Well, American culture sometimes doesn't use the intestine. I mean, we've got, you know, different sorts of skins and things like that. There is a little bit of wiggle room in the sausage definition. So, you know, generally it is using an intestinal casing to, you know, because that makes the most sense, right? I mean, especially if you're trying to use all of the pieces of the animal, you're going to want to use its intestines as well as, you know, all of the sort of obviously edible bits. But, you know, there's also a question of, well, should you consider something like a sausage patty? You know, that's a chopped meat and it's kind of put back together in a form and it's cooked. You know, haggis, it is cooked in a sheep's stomach, but it's not quite the same as the intestine. So there's a lot of kind of wiggle in the definition of a sausage. But yeah, for the most part, it's a casing kind of thing.
You know, given that some sausages were basically the bits of meat swept off the floor, held together with blood and who knows what else, maybe some lymph, did sausage ever get a reputation as a food of the lower classes?
It did. The thing that makes sausage so useful, you know, that you can put sort of bits of it that you wouldn't necessarily want to eat outright into it and make it edible and tasty, is also the same thing that sort of gives it a somewhat of a stigma. So, you know, while there is definitely evidence that people across class divide ate sausages. I mean, Queen Victoria preferred hers to be chopped rather than minced, the meat inside to be chopped rather than minced. At the same time, because they were something that you could use the bits of meat that weren't kind of the nicest, then it did become associated with affordability, and that tends to be associated with lower classes.
Right.
And of course, you know, by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, sausage did have a bit of a negative reputation, one I think that kind of persists a little bit to this day.
Where did the phrase hot dog come from?
From what I understand, the phrase was coined at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and it came from hot dog sellers, usually at games and at, like, baseball games and things like that, calling the hot dogs Dachshund sausages.
Hmm.
So they used to shout out, you know, get your red hot Dachshund sausages, because they came from, you know, they were Frankfurters. They had this German heritage.
Right.
They looked like sausage dogs. And this Hearst newspaper cartoonist decided to draw a sketch of this scene of a hot dog seller selling hot dogs. But he couldn't spell Dachshund. So instead of writing, get your red hot Dachshund sausage, he wrote, just get your red hot dog.
Perfect.
And that became it from 1906 on.
Linda Rodriguez McRobbie wrote about sausages for the website Atlas Obscura. Thank you very much. This is a lot of news about sausages.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We've been hearing a lot in the past few weeks about Puerto Rico's financial troubles. They are serious. Even with the U.S. government pledging some support, the island is on the brink of a default. But our next story isn't about Puerto Rico's looming debt. It's about baseball on the island. The World's Jason Margolis visited a high school baseball academy in the rural Puerto Rican town of Florida.
Boys work out with shiny new equipment, weights and ropes. If they get sore, there are hot tubs to soak aching muscles. Pretty different from when Alex Diaz grew up.
During the Monday to Friday, we just work out with our parents, friends. Now they have everything here. I got that facility when I make it to the big league.
Diaz played 8 seasons of Major League Baseball in the 1990s. Now he runs the athletic department at the Carlos Beltran Baseball Academy, one of 5 private baseball high schools in Puerto Rico.
They practice baseball 5 days a week. They study 5 days a week. They have 3 meals down here. They got everything down here.
The boys focus on baseball for 3 hours each weekday, including taking swings in the batting cages. Baseball used to be the sport in Puerto Rico. Now it competes with volleyball, boxing, and basketball. That last one, Diaz can't figure out.
I don't know. I don't really know. I don't know, because in basketball you have to be like 7 feet tall. It's a strange, because Puerto Rican, the most tall they can get is like 6'3", 6'4".
He has a point. Name a Puerto Rican NBA player. Exactly. There's only been a handful, and no superstars. But more than 200 Puerto Ricans have played Major League Baseball, including names like Roberto Clemente, Orlando Cepeda, and Ivan Pudge Rodriguez. Still, many Puerto Rican teens today do gravitate first to baseball. At the academy here, nearly 400 boys try out each year for a spot. 1 in 10 make it.
2 horas y media, prácticamente.
High school junior Manuel Castillo travels 2.5 hours each direction by bus to get here.
Yo me levanto a las 3:30.
3 o'clock in the morning.
Llego a casa a las 7.
He leaves home at 3 in the morning each day, gets home around 7 at night, studies for a few hours, then goes to bed at 10.
Me gustaría ir a coger una beca universitaria.
After high school, he wants to go to college. Then he says, God willing, to play in the major leagues. For kids like Castillo, baseball can be a way out of poverty. 45% of Puerto Ricans live below the poverty line. Carlos Beltran, the namesake of the school, grew up nearby with not much either.
You know, we have food on the table because my dad did a good job and my mom to provide us that. But, there were times when we didn't have money to go to school, or there were times where, you know, we only had one pair of shoes.
Those days are long gone.
Batting third of the Yankees lineup is the designated hitter, number 36, Carlos Beltran.
Beltran now plays for the New York Yankees. We spoke at Yankee Stadium before a game. Beltran is 39 and has been one of baseball's best players over the past 2 decades. He's picked up a truckload of honors, including the Roberto Clemente Award, given annually to one major league player who exemplifies the best of sportsmanship and community involvement. Beltran won not long after he started his school 5 years ago. He puts several $100,000 of his own money into it each year. He can afford it. He earns $15 million a year from the Yankees. Beltran says he knows he's been fortunate. That's why at his school, academics come first.
Because I only 1%, you know, make it to the big league. So it's a very, very, very small window. So I try to create an environment where the kids really focus on education. And at the same time, you know, they will continue to develop themselves as a ball player.
That's important. Baseball can be a ticket to a college scholarship for talented players. Puerto Rico's public high schools have been plagued by high dropout rates. Not Beltran's academy. Alex Diaz says all the boys hope to be signed by a major league organization.
The class this year is like 40 kids. Probably they're going to sign like 3 or 4. The rest is going to be at college.
All of them?
All of them.
Every single one?
Every single one.
Every single one also has a full or partial scholarship as well, often to schools on the U.S. mainland. There's another thing that sets the Beltran Academy apart from many other Puerto Rican schools, explains Gabriel Arroyo. He's going to be a junior.
I think like the most important thing is that all the class is on English.
That's important for life and for baseball. For example, a coach can yell for Arroyo to hit his cutoff man. I asked how you'd say that in Spanish.
That's the thing that I know in English, but not Spanish.
Arroyo spoke English with relative ease, but picking up a second language seemed to be a work in progress for most of the boys.
They understand you. The thing is, they're afraid to talk in English.
Still, the boys here are much further along than Carlos Beltran was when he was drafted by the Kansas City Royals as a teenager.
No English. And it was very hard for me because the language was a barrier for me.
Besides just the kids at his academy, Beltran is also trying to help rebuild Puerto Rico's rich baseball tradition. The island has been eclipsed by Venezuela and the Dominican Republic as the major exporters of Latin American baseball talent. That's largely because major league teams have set up baseball academies in those countries. Beltran is trying to help give Puerto Rican boys a chance to compete.
I'm doing the best I can to try to do something positive for my country.
And yeah, baseball's just a game. But ballplayers are heroes to a lot of kids and grown-ups. Beltran's accomplishments bring pride to Puerto Ricans. Beltran gets that. And that's why he wants to help produce the next crop of Puerto Rican stars to take his place. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
If you want an inside look at one of Puerto Rico's baseball academies, search no more. We have a load of photos up at PRI.org. No, that's not the organ at a baseball park. This is the band Miramar, most of whose members have families in Puerto Rico. And Miramar's debut album is dedicated to a Puerto Rican composer named Silvia Resach. She wasn't even 40 when she died in 1961 of cancer, but Resach had already made huge strides for women artists in Puerto Rico. She was a self-taught musician and blazed her own bohemian path to fame, founded Puerto Rico's first all-female band, had a radio show, and composed songs that are standards today in Puerto Rico. We'll close today's program with Miramar's take on Silvia Resach and one of her boleros called Por Siempre. Our theme music, composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Whether your weekend is long or short, I hope it's a good one. Mira esa luna y sabrás lo que ocurre dentro de mi corazón. No guardes temor de otros amores, pues para mí no hay amores si no me saben a ti. Piensa que tu nombre ya ha sellado la raíz del corazón y quedará por siempre así. PRI, Public Radio International.